Mr. Ballinger, there?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Ballinger. I'm the director of the Appellate Litigation Clinic at the University of Virginia School of Law. And it's my pleasure to introduce Ms. Jahan McCullough and Ms. Nina Oat, who will be presenting argument for Mr. Dean. Ms. McCullough will handle the opening argument, and Ms. Oat will handle the rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Welcome, Cavaliers. McCullough?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jahan McCullough, representing the appellant. We have two separate uses of force against Mr. Dean. A reasonable jury could infer a legal retaliatory motive in both. In the first incident, regarding the excessive use of the pepper spray, the district court simply misunderstood the body positions of Mr. Dean and Officer Gibson at the time of the force. The district court's order assumes that Mr. Dean was handcuffed in front of his body with his legs tucked up and the officer was pushing on his legs. The actual facts are that Mr. Dean was on the floor and handcuffed behind his back, and Officer Gibson was kneeling on Mr. Dean's chest. A reasonable jury could conclude that he was clearly restrained at that point. In the second incident, officers restrained Mr. Dean by pushing him against the wall. 13 officers were there, and they were all capable of controlling the situation. After Mr. Dean was restrained, Officer Jones decided to shout, "Get him in there," and the officers then shoved Mr. Dean into a broom closet where there was no camera. They proceeded to beat the living daylights out of him for at least a minute while repeatedly shouting, "You done messed up." A reasonable trier of fact could infer retaliatory intent from that alone. Your Honors, we urge you to watch the video, which shows the area outside of the broom closet. Officers were not in danger of losing control of Mr. Dean before he got thrown into the closet, and the ones who stayed outside of the closet remained calm when Dean was inside the closet. And Officer Jones's statements are clear and direct evidence of his state of mind. The summary judgment standard requires the district court to resolve all material disputes of fact.
Can I just ask a question about the statements that were made or allegedly made by Officer Jones? Is it your position that that direct evidence would be enough by itself to, or could be enough by itself to show the forbidden motive under the Eighth Amendment? What if the Whitley factors came out the other way, but you have the statements, then what do you do?
Yes, Your Honor. The statements alone provide that direct evidence. However, we need to consider those statements with the context. So, yes, that is a component of the direct evidence. However, based on the context and what we can also see and gather, a jury can infer the officers were retaliating against Mr. Dean. So we do need to look at the totality of the circumstance, yes.
I want to ask you just a follow-up about how the Whitley factors and the direct evidence interact. So what if you had a case where it was clear under Whitley that a reasonable officer could use force? Say it's one prisoner not in handcuffs, one officer, the prisoner lunges at the officer, and so the officer uses pepper spray. But while he's using the pepper spray, he says, "I'm not scared of you, buddy, but you disrespected me, and now you have to pay the price." So under the Whitley factors, objectively speaking, a reasonable officer maybe could use force to control the situation. But when we look at the direct evidence, what the officer is saying, he's saying he did it for a retaliatory purpose. How does that case come out?
Your Honor, that hypothetical in regards to using the pepper spray and while making statements, we need to look at the context as well in regards to de minimis force or more than de minimis force.
Okay, I'm sorry. Assume he punched him or used a taser. Let's take out the question of whether it satisfies the objective prong. It does satisfy the objective prong. I'm just trying to get at, why do you need the Whitley factors if you have direct evidence?
The Whitley factor, Your Honor, the Whitley factors will help us with circumstantial evidence, but we do not need the Whitley factors if we have direct evidence. So we need to look at both the direct evidence and circumstantial both together. And the alternative, it is the alternative under Brooks. I'd also like to turn our attention to other statements. In Brooks and Orem, this court found summary judgment improper because the inmate's statements to officers were so inflammatory that the jury could infer the officers were retaliating. Here, it is actually the officer making the inflammatory statements that provide a direct window into his retaliatory frame of mind. So there, we can see that direct evidence through the state of mind of Officer Jones in his retaliatory state of mind. Also, in most previous cases, Boone versus Stallings, Ico, Grayson versus Pede, the court recognized the inmate was restrained once the officers got him into handcuffs. And in our case, Mr. Dean was handcuffed behind his back the entire time, before both incidents. Plus, in the first incident, he was pinned to the floor with an officer kneeling on his chest. In the second incident, he was surrounded by 13 officers. In Mann, where there was the question about whether the inmate was restrained, even though in Mann, the inmate was especially violent, this court reversed summary judgment there because a jury could find that the officers continued to apply force after Mann was restrained. In addition, the district court improperly relied on the officer's testimony. Officers' inconsistencies have never provided a reliable account of the closet incident. For example, the witness statements have six different explanations. Some said Mr. Dean fell in with the officers. Some said Mr. Dean was placed on the ground by the officers. Some said Mr. Dean fell by himself. Officer Jones said in his affidavit that Mr. Dean hit the right side of his face on a protruding shelf. However, the majority of Mr. Dean's injuries were on the left side of his face. These inconsistencies make summary judgment improper, and the district court should not have made credibility determinations on these facts. It is up for a jury to decide.
So are we in agreement here that we are essentially talking about the subjective prong on this case here? And as I understand your argument, it seems to be your focus is that the district court just didn't look at use the right standard. It did not look at the evidence in the light most favorable in this instance. And that presents a problem at least in terms of whether a reasonable jury could differ and you would get around this summary judgment at this stage if an issue of fact is created. Is that essentially where you're going with this?
I hear much better now, Mr. Bellinger.
I believe
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
I believe. I'm sorry, okay. Your Honor.
Sorry, Your Honor, if you could repeat the question.
My question really goes to just a look at whether we're talking about the subjective prong or the objective one. And it appears to me if we focus on force with the subjective one, which is the objective one, which is what the Supreme Court has directed us to do, pepper spray gets around that. And maybe even the use of force in and of itself gets around the objective one. So the focus here is on the subjective one and the district court's treatment of it. If I'm understanding your argument, your main point is that the district court did not view this evidence in the right light, in the light favorable to the defendant here, so as to preclude entry of summary judgment because there's an issue of fact, or issues of fact for the court to consider.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, that's exactly right.
So, my point in doing it is then it would seem to me the specific thing to do would be to point out those particular facts that you think the district court did not correctly view properly here that creates the issue of fact. If that's so, then this is a pretty simple inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. There are a great deal of facts. For example, once Dean was restrained in the first incident and the second incident, he was no longer resisting. And in the first incident, although we don't have video footage to review that, but in the second incident, we can see that the officers were not feeling a sense of urgency or threat after he was restrained up against the wall. Then they decided to throw Mr. Dean into the closet. However, the district court did not consider, they misunderstood the facts of the positioning of Mr. Dean and the officer when he was pinned to the ground. So these are examples of where the district court missed. And they also did not consider Jones's statement, which is direct evidence into the retaliatory state of mind. The statement of "you done messed up" and the order to quote "get him in there" in regards to the broom closet and pushing Dean into the broom closet.
Can I ask you a question about the clearly established prong, which the district court didn't rely on, but the officers are arguing now? So I take it that you are sort of more or less conceding that at the moment of the headbutts, you know, some force could have been used to restrain Mr. Dean. So what is the case most clearly on point that says that you can't use force against an inmate who did present some kind of a physical threat, but no longer does because now he's restrained? What's the case most directly on point for that?
Your Honor, I would point to Mann here. The Mann case is a great example, a very violent inmate in that case. And the facts show that the officers continued to use force after Mann was restrained. And yes.
Is Mann a published case or unpublished?
Mann is unpublished, Your Honor.
Right. What's the closest authority in a published authority? Because I think for clearly established purposes, we look at published cases.
Brooks and Iko, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, you mentioned clearly established law. In this case, there are clearly established laws in this circuit. Mann, as I mentioned, although unpublished. Thompson. And in Thompson, the officers were already on notice. It clearly established that excessive use of force beyond the restraint of an inmate is illegal and unaccepted. Your Honor, do you have any other questions? I'm happy to answer any further questions that you may have.
All right. There seem to be none.
Okay. So Okay, thank you, Your Honors. I will reserve the rest of the time for my colleague.
Thank you. Ms. Oak?
Can you hear me, Your Honors?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Your Honors. In this particular case, as evident by the argument today and the brief by the plaintiff, their arguments challenging the district court's order are flawed in a couple of ways. And the first way that it's flawed is that he's kind of asking this court to look at these as two completely separate incidents. They happen 2 minutes apart. One informs the other. And they simply were not separate incidents. So yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'm surprised to hear you make that argument. I would have thought you would be arguing whatever might have happened on his account when they pushed him into a closet with no camera and beat him for a minute while making statements indicating retaliatory intent. Put that to one side when you look at the first one, which seems much more reasonable. But you want us to look at them together?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I may have overstated that. I want you to look at them separate. But the first one certainly informs the second one. And I would submit that the second one informs the first one, too. Because from the time that Mr. Dean headbutted Officer Hobgood, those officers did not have control of him. Because he would go on and headbutt a second officer while they are moving him to the decontamination station at the nurse's station. And the second headbutt, yes, it followed a period in which there was no specific incident. But there's no other way to view that second headbutt as anything other than a signal to the officers that they never had control of him, they didn't have control of him during the escort, handcuffs behind his back, Officer Gibbons having previously put his knees to his chest, the pepper spray, the 13 officers, two officers, one of which he says was holding his wrist severely, none of that was sufficient to control Dean.
The primary issue we face, these are difficult cases, I understand, and it comes about because you're looking kind of, what you want to do is kind of look at the totality of the circumstances here, but you do have to break them up, and what Judge Harris was alluding to, the pushing into the closet and beating for 1 minute, you want to tie that into the first and say it informed that. I don't know what it informed except a retaliatory action that happens in the closet. But beyond that, if we're looking at the evidence, this is where it gets really difficult for a district court and anybody to look at, is on the summary judgment stage, we're only looking at the evidence in the light most favorable. And when you go into that mode, this evidence shows, not like the district court who stated that the Gibson was holding plaintiff's knees to his chest, it was actually Gibson's own knee that was against Dean's chest. And the district court just didn't consider that. The evidence, at least from the defendant's perspective, was he was down on with his handcuff behind his back, lying on the floor with Gibson's knee and weight on the top of his chest. You can't do a lot of headbutting in that kind of position at that point. And then so the question really becomes, you know, at what point? It could start out that they may have been justified in doing what they did, but is there a point when we view the evidence in the light most favorable, where this becomes not a penological justification, but it becomes a retaliatory or some type of other infliction of punishment? And certainly the language that the district court didn't even mention, the graphic language that was used, that you messed up something to that effect and that, you know, we're going to get you sort of thing. That's evidence to look at in a light most favorable that could lead to a conclusion that a reasonable jury could decide this was, in fact, beyond penological justification. This was more retaliatory. It was malicious-type conduct. That's the issue, I think, that I see in the case from the subjective prong perspective.
And you're talking specifically about the second incident, Your Honor.
Let's make sure we're talking about the same thing. First instance, are we talking about the pepper spray?
Your Honor, with regards to, I'm sorry that I confused it. But with regards to, there are two separate.
I simply want to know what you call the first and second incident. That's all at this point.
The first use of force was the pepper spray. The second one was the force in the closet. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so I'm really talking about both. I'm talking about viewing the light, evidence in the light most favorable. And even with the pepper spray, the question is, was he subdued on the floor with the knee in the chest, with his hands handcuffed behind his back? At that time, was that at a point at which he would be subdued? Because I understand it was at that point the pepper spray was put on him. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But you view the threat from the perspective of the officers. That is what Whitley says you do. Yes, you take plaintiff's evidence as proof, and you construe it in his favor. But when you're looking at the factors, you judge those factors. The extent of the threat is judged as reasonably perceived by the staff. And it was a fast-evolving situation there. Officer Hopgood had been the point that he was knocked down. And can you hear me, Your Honors? The video went out, but I'm going to continue.
Yes.
Yes.
And so he was headbutted to the point that he was knocked down. He got up and he pepper sprayed out of officer safety. It was proportional. There was a need to do it. And, of course, we disagree with the district court on one thing, and that is he did temper it because of an issue with tempering. The use of force with regards to pepper spray is immediate contamination. They offered immediate contamination. In fact, they were walking him there when he headbutted the second officer. So under all of that, if you look at the Whitley factors as to the pepper spray incident, it was clear that there was no wanton or maliciousness there as found by the district court, and the district court correctly analyzed that situation.
My question, though, is even with the Whitley factors, if the evidence in the light most favorable shows he has his hands handcuffed behind his back, and the officer has a knee to his chest holding him down, what is the need for the application of force at that point? That's really where we're going, and then the relationship and the amount of force that's being used at that point. Those are the factors we're looking at. And it's not a question of whether we can find an interpretation that would support, okay, the Whitney factors aren't needed. The issue is whether a reasonable jury could find otherwise. In other words, everything you're saying is quite reasonable, but is that the only conclusion to reach from this, or is there a jury question here that can arise from this?
Well, Your Honor, it's our contention that there is no jury question.
I understand that, but that doesn't keep there from being one because you simply contend there is not one.
There is.
And that's what I'm trying to get at is could a reasonable jury decide that a man whose hands are behind his back, handcuffed, and then the officer is on him with his knee to his chest in a subdued situation, and then the defendant even said, you know, he couldn't do anything. He's saying he's out. I'm not sure how much that weight that goes, but he says it. And then you got the officer basically saying statements that could be interpreted as though he's really not happy, and no one's happy about being headbutted or his buddy being headbutted, that you've messed up now. Basically, it's almost we're going to get you, which leads to the second incident, I know. But the question is that sufficient evidence that would take this to the jury?
No, Your Honor, it is not. If you're looking at that, you're looking at the situation from the point of that officer, an officer who was headbutted when he got up, he saw this. You know, Dean's legs were still, were not restrained. And that's what the officer would have saw. He was immediately headbutted before the pepper spray. So, no, a reasonable jury would not do that any other way. That's why the district court was correct in finding that he had not established excessive force claim with regards to the pepper spray.
Ms. Babb, Judge Harris has a question.
Thank
Sorry,
you.
Sorry, you can't see us anymore.
I cannot.
All right, sorry. Counsel, so I have a question about this. It seemed to me in reading the district court's opinion that what the district court was saying was something like this. Look, and similar to what you're saying, there was a moment when there was a headbutt and it was necessary to restrain or get under control this inmate. And the force was used pretty close to that time, you know, immediately after. Like there's almost a safe harbor. Like once you need to use force, you get like a little buffer zone around that during which you can continue to use force. Because a reasonable officer might think that was necessary. And my concern is that we have said in so many cases that that is not correct. That this is a second by second inquiry and that at the very moment force becomes unnecessary. Even if it had been necessary until then, at the very moment it becomes unnecessary, you have to stop using it. And it looked to me like the district court was not applying that standard, that it was saying something more like, you know, close enough. It's all part of the same couple of minutes. And if force was necessary at one point, you know, we give you a little wiggle room. But that's just not where our case law is. So I'm hoping you can address that for me.
Well, you're right. That's not what the case is, and that's not what the district court was saying. The district court was saying the way it was. It was Officer Hobgood would, in his position, you judge it according to Whitley and in other cases, it's judged from the concerns that are facing the official, and what he would have seen is he immediately rose up after being headbutted by the inmate. And he pepper sprayed the other officer, and it was
Ms. Babb, you said an important thing. You said, I like the way you framed it. I want you to take your frame and I'll answer your question. You said he was headbutted. Then when he got himself together, he saw, and then you went to pepper spray. Answer your question. What would he have seen based on this undisputed record? Or at least we have to take in light of the non-moving party. Am I correct? He would have seen a person handcuffed, his hands behind him, on the deck with an officer, correctional officer's knees on his chest. Now go back to what you said. That's what he have seen. And you're saying that as a matter of law, that raises a question of fact in terms of that he could then walk over to what he saw and spray him for about 3 seconds and directly in his eyes. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor, it's not my position because that recitation you gave is from what we are looking at here in the calm of a remote argument.
It's not in the calm. You said it. You framed it well. You said what he would have seen. You didn't say what would he have thought. What he saw was a man handcuffed with his hands behind him and another man with his knees on his chest. And you're saying that's he's justified in going over to what that scene is and spraying him in the eyes for 3 seconds, correct?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. I mean, and you know, for what it's worth, Mr. Dean's legs were still free. He was completely justified.
Counsel, can I stop you there? What do you mean by his legs were free? Because as Judge Wynn was saying, this is a place where the district court actually misunderstood the record and what the officer would have seen. So he's got one officer kneeling on his chest while he's lying on his back. What are his legs free to do? I don't understand. Like, I suppose he could beat his feet on the ground, but that's all he can do with his legs. It's not what the district court thought, which was that the officer was leaning on his legs to push his legs down. If that were true, then conceivably, I suppose, he could have kicked out with his legs at the officer. But if the officer is kneeling on his chest, his legs are behind that officer. I don't even understand what the legs could do. Why is that even relevant that his legs are free?
Well, he could kick Officer Hobgood.
Only if his legs bend backwards, how could he possibly kick him? If he is leaning on, if the officer, where is Officer Hodgood standing? Under his feet?
We don't, obviously that's impossible, but we don't have any evidence from Mr. Dean about that at all. But from Officer Hodgood's perspective, he had just been headbutted. He didn't use any sort of physical force along with this pepper spraying of the eyes. There's no case in this circuit case law that defendant has cited. All those cases about the pepper spray are completely distinguishable from the situation that happened in this case. They are cases where the inmate had not done a violent act almost immediately before the pepper spray. There's clearly no longer a threat in those cases. There's greater use of chemical agents, and there's refusal to decontaminate for hours afterwards. And here we have, he's offered immediate decontamination. The only reason that he wasn't contaminated was by his own actions in headbutting the second officer.
Counsel, can I ask you about the alleged statements by Officer Jones? I just want to make sure I understand your position on these statements. Is it your position that unless a claimant can show malice indirectly under the Whitley factors, you can't look at the direct evidence coming out of the officer's mouth?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position at all. You can look at direct evidence. I would just say these were not statements are direct evidence in situations where you have internal processes like whether something's malicious or sadistic. It's rare that you're going to have direct evidence. And to have these statements, I just don't see that the nature of the statements here, the way that they are not direct evidence of retaliation. You can certainly, they're nowhere near what was said in that unpublished case in Mann, and even though it's unpublished and those are not within the universe of clearly established law for qualified immunity purposes, you can compare those statements there to the ones here, which were arguably clearly retaliatory. I'm going to beat you like your mother should have, threatening to beat the inmate ass, excuse my language. And Mann is just a completely distinguishable from the present case. I also wanted to just make a quick point about words. Plaintiff relies upon cases about words coming from the inmate and uses of force that follow words from the inmate. Those are completely different situations. Those were the case of Orem, I believe, in the unpublished opinion in Sawyer that was cited by a defendant. In those particular cases, when you have force in response to words, they manifest, there's like a manifest situation, manifesting those circumstances that we look at and that we say shows malice and retaliation.
Okay. Counsel, let me just, I just want to make sure I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So, yes, an officer's statements can be relevant evidence. In your view, though, the district court did not err by just ignoring these statements because no reasonable jury could infer from these statements a retaliatory motive? Is that your position? It's
yes,
not
Your
even
Honor.
A jury question? Okay.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a different situation when you have force in response to language from an inmate. There's manifest, manifest disproportionality. You have an immediate question of whether there is need for that. And you don't have the same thing you have when you have statements from the officer. So those particular cases do not inform the situation.
Your position is that statements from the prisoner are more probative of what the officer is thinking than statements from the officer. That's your position.
No, Your Honor. My position is that's a different situation because in those particular circumstances, they manifest those circumstance, that particular situation manifests those circumstances that automatically show retaliation. The response when it's the use of force in response to vulgar language, that's just your mind automatically goes to, that's disproportionate. That wasn't needed. Whereas when you have statements, you're going to want to look at the totality of the circumstances. I mean, the plaintiff has admitted that you look at the totality of the circumstances. And that's exactly what the court
Counsel, let me just ask you the same hypothetical then that I asked your colleague. Is it your position that if you look at the circumstances under Whitley and it seems as though a reasonable officer could have applied force for a permissible reason, but in applying the force, this officer says out loud, I'm doing this in a retaliatory way. I am doing this because I am angry at you. How does that case come out?
I think that that goes to the jury because you have direct statements saying, I'm retaliating against you. Similar to the Mann case where you had the officer saying, I'm going to beat your ASS and I'm going to beat you like your mother should have. That's a different situation.
So you don't have to look at all of the circumstances then. It's just you can go to the jury on the statement if the statement speaks a retaliatory motive.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the statements that you proposed in the hypothetical are directly, I mean, they said, I'm retaliating against you.
Right.
That's not what we have here. That's more like what they had in the Mann case. If I could ask what my time is, I can't see the clock.
Yeah, Ms. Bebb, your time is expired, but I'm going to give you 5 minutes, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor. And with regard to the second use of force in the fog, the objective evidence from the video was that this was a very short period of time. After the headbutt to taking him to the wall, to in the closet, was maybe, being generous, 4 to 5 seconds. Again, this was a fast-evolving situation. He had not been controlled previously by there being 13 officers around him, being handcuffed. So physical force was needed. There's no other way to look at that than to say that it was needed. And any movement that he would have made under these circumstances where he headbutted one officer, went for a period and didn't have any incident, and then headbutted another officer, any movement on his part would have been seen as some sort of additional resistance by these officers. I think Mann also offers a good comparison on that point, too. Because in Mann, you had two uses of force where the officers were given very, very clear indication that the defendant was subdued. In one instance, the July 27th to 28th use of force in Mann, an officer interposed himself between Mann and the defendant in that case and said, he's subdued. Yet she continued to hit him as he is being carried down the hallway. In another instance in Mann, the August 23rd use of force, you had Mann saying, I'm done, I'm down, those kind of things. He also had affidavits from other prisoners saying similar things. So here, any movement that he had made would have been seen as continued resistance under the circumstances that existed in this case. And here, plaintiff notes that he was taken to the wall and that he was restrained by four officers, and so the movement in the closet was unnecessary. So these officers had to move him. They couldn't just stay right there. He was not in the confines of his cell. They had to, per policy, have him decontaminated. So the movement into the isolated space of the closet and the physical force used there was not excessive as found by the district court. With regards to qualified immunity, the defendants obviously understand that the cases that are looked at do not have to be materially different. They do not have to be exactly like the case that we have here to do that. But plaintiff has not brought forward, as Judge Harris indicated, any cases that are exactly like what we have in this case. And understanding what the Fourth Circuit has said about Eighth Amendment excessive force challenges and qualified immunity, the U.S. Supreme Court, and really neither this court, has said there could not be some room between finding a violation and qualified immunity, and offered as a letter of additional authority that case from the Fifth Circuit, which is currently pending at the U.S. Supreme Court on a petition, where the court said, well, where you have done the Whitley factors, and you have inferred malice from them, but less than all of them, less than all of them favor the plaintiff, that is not an obvious violation, and therefore the officer was entitled to qualified immunity. So it just gives an example of there may be an example of when there is or could be some room between finding the violation and qualified immunity. And if there are no other questions, I'd ask that you affirm the district court's order.
Thank you, Ms. Babb.
Thank you.
Ms. Oak?
May it please the court. My name is Nina Oak for the appellant. I'd like to touch on a couple of things. The first is that there is no illogical reason for shoving an inmate into a closet where there is no camera. Counsel did not provide an explanation for this, for shoving him into the closet where there was no camera. The record does not show that the guards provided any explanation for doing this other than retaliatory intent. And it's difficult to think of a situation in which that would theoretically exist. It's a space where there are shelves and they keep boxes and it's for storage and they don't have a camera there. And so clearly there is no purpose. The prison did not intend for this to be something that the prison guards could do with any legitimate penological reason. The same applies to the pepper spray. It's impossible to think of a specific reason that is not about retaliation to directly spray and practically empty the can into someone's eyes when the inmate is down on the floor, lying on his back, with his hands handcuffed behind him. Without these reasons, it's hard to imagine a situation where we couldn't infer retaliatory intent. And so under the Whitley factors on that issue, summary judgment is clearly precluded. The second issue I'd like to talk about is Judge Harris's discussion about the distinction between direct evidence and indirect evidence and the role that the Whitley factors play in this kind of analysis. So first of all, what someone says, a statement that someone makes, is the closest thing to direct evidence of someone's state of mind that we can get. So contrary to what the government states, the officer's statements are actually more valuable as direct evidence than the statements from the inmates. And this court has held that summary judgment is inappropriate when we have statements from the plaintiffs that indicate the state of mind of the officer. So this is an even lower bar to clear. And we have clear indication from the statements that Officer Jones made, get him in there, you done messed up, while hitting him at the same time. And Brooks is clear regarding the distinction and the role that this kind of evidence plays. Brooks is clear that both direct evidence and indirect evidence play a role, but the Whitley factors are not exclusive. They're alternative ways of reaching inferences that summary judgment is inappropriate because when we look at the facts, yeah, most favorable to Dean, which is required by the summary judgment standard, in our case, we get there both ways, but you can get there either way, which is very clear from this court in Brooks. So in this case, we have the direct evidence of the statements. We have the you done messed up and the get him in their statements. Those are the direct evidence. Those lead to an inference, or could lead to an inference, that a jury should be determining that question and the intent behind it. In addition, we also have the kind of circumstantial evidence that is used in the Whitley analysis. So while both are not necessarily required, in this case, because we have both, it's an even stronger reason for why summary judgment is not appropriate in this case. And finally, the last thing I'd like to touch on is...
You talk about that these inferences to be drawn is what gives rise to factual questions. But these are not hypotheticals, nor counterfactuals at all. It really is the facts. It's undisputed here that your client provoked this incident. Correct?
Yes. Right. I apologize, Your Honor.
They run together. You can say there's incident part A, part B, but he provoked it, right? Correct?
Yes.
All right. And what you have is someone, and I think counsel, Ms. Baird, was saying he was headbutted, and then he sort of comes to, you know what I mean when I say the race just time, right? The thing
I apologize, Your Honor. Would you mind repeating that?
You know what it means by the race just time? I know I'm in law school 40-some years ago. We had to speak Latin a little bit, but, you know, it's the thing happening. The race just died, the thing kind of happened. Well, isn't that part of the race just died, the provocation? You're head-butted, you kind of, you know, you see stars, as most people, you know, your head shakes and you come up and this person is dangerous, right? Even when subdued, he's dangerous, correct?
Yes.
All right, so then he does something with a non-lethal force. He uses pepper spray it's not lethal. It's you wash your eyes out. Nobody wants to be pepper sprayed, but certainly in terms of in the range of things, he didn't beat him or hit him with a stick or kick him or he pepper sprayed him. And then after that, your client's head butted again. So even under the pepper spray, you might say there's evidence that it may have been de minimis because he was able to, without decontamination, rev it up again to provoke another incident, correct?
Your Honor, I think there are a couple of points in there
is that correct? Is that correct? He provoked
another
incident, right?
Yes.
And then with 13 officers around him, right, he did that.
Yes.
All right. Now, you said his statement saying you have effed up now. It was probably correct. He did, didn't he?
Yes.
All right, and the other thing is that we need to get him into this room, right?
Get him in there, I believe is the statement.
But get him in there, right?
Yes.
Well, why couldn't the prison officials say, well, we don't want anybody around to see this. It just incites potentially more problems. Let's isolate him. Why is that not just isolation, getting him into the room?
Regarding the isolation issue, I think that brings us back to maybe the purpose of the janitor's closet. There's no penological reason for using a closet that has shelves and tools and boxes and no camera in it to carry out some legitimate use of, you know, prison guard authority. Regarding your other question about whether or not, you know, whether or not it is true that he messed up. That is absolutely possible that, you know, that one could say he messed up. He did mess up. He headbutted an officer. But it's about the intent of the officer while making the statement and the fact that he was also kicking him and beating him while he was saying these statements. That matters. In the context of the way he was saying these things, the things he was doing while he was saying them, and the fact that he was not resisting at the time changes the way that those statements play into it.
In your best case that he was in the closet, but going in the closet may have a penological reason, but the point is, a minute later when he came out, he had been pulverized and bloody. So therefore, wouldn't that be the factual question as to what happened? whether it was penological or whether he was resisting, whether he was on the floor, we don't know. Isn't that the problem? Isn't that the real factual question?
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I have leave to answer your question?
Certainly. Isn't that the factual question that can't be resolved just on qualified immunity or just, that's a fact question, right?
It is a fact question, but it's a fact question that has to go to the jury. And that's exactly the issue that we have here. Regarding,
but I mean, that's what I'm saying. You may be overstating your case in the sense that you're putting on more things than you have to, in the sense, because some of those things, well, your case as it is, but that's the, you know, this would be a hard case if it stopped right there and you never went in the closet. Wouldn't it be a harder case?
It would be a harder case, Your Honor, but he did go in the closet.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the fast question. We don't know what happened. We do know the consequences of what happened when he came out. He was bloodied and clearly beaten.
Exactly. And for those foregoing reasons, we ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Mr. Ballinger, Professor, thank you so much. And you're court appointed. And on behalf of the Fourth Circuit, we thank you so much for that. And more importantly, thank you so much for bringing these wonderful students from the University of Virginia, who acquitted themselves very well as Cavaliers today, and we thank them so much. And obviously, Ms. Babb, we thank you so much for your very able representation as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. We appreciate the opportunity.
And we wish we could come down and shake hands. We can't, but know that the sentiment is felt, and we appreciate your arguments. Thank you so much. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn the court for today.
This honorable court stands adjourned. God save the United States and this honorable court.